After that training on that Saturday, those youth will be invited to bring their parents on Sunday to the restaurant, and the youth will serve dinner to their parents. So that's a wonderful opportunity with this program, and not only teaching these children new skills and introducing to them another piece of American culture, if you will, going to a five-star restaurant, but they'll actually be able to do something for their parents. So one of the things that I'm always excited about in working with youth is taking them out of that stigma of being disposable, not having anything to offer, and putting them in a position of empowerment where they're able to give something back and receive that kind of support and encouragement. The other thing that I'm going to do is replay a tape that I had shared on the first presentation, recognizing that many of you were not able to be here for that event, and a commercial while I have you. Since being here at Holden for my first time and seeing the wonderful relationships in this environment, one of my goals is to bring a group of children here from the program who are at risk to Holden for a weekend. And not only will that be able to bring them into this beautiful setting, one which is totally foreign to most of the kids that we work with, but also the adults who will be able to be there in that relationship of mentors and role models, spending that kind of time in travel, on the boat, and in relationship here and hiking. It's a wonderful opportunity to bring those youth here. So I mentioned that to you, and I don't know how I'm going to fund that yet, but I may have to develop some scholarship here at Holden to make that become a reality. And then the final piece is the videotape that I will show, and just a brief introduction to that is I used to teach at Oregon Episcopal School, and some of you may know of that school from the accident, the tragic accident we had on Mount Hood about 6 years ago, 7 years ago. And that's an affluent advantage community. And I've been able to go back there since I left there to take this ministry on, and approaching those youth to be involved with youth who are at the other end of the spectrum, the disadvantaged youth, certainly by our social standards. And in every opportunity that I presented to those youth, they've responded quite generously. And this Christmas party is a party that the youth put on expressing their knowledge that they're in a shared community. So I want to share that with you. It's just one of the simple approaches to bringing community together and youth empowerment. So I'm going to try to get this going. If anybody has worked this before.
Crime, gang violence, murder. All too often they intrude on everyday life in many parts of Portland. One group took advantage of the holiday season to bring some relief to a group of children, as Paul Gallen reports.
The sounds of this season, from the children of some of Portland's meanest streets, kids who all too often live with other sounds. In neighborhoods like this one, violence seems a way of life at times. The volunteers who run the community project for at-risk youth are trying to give these kids something else. And new friends. At-risk kids paired with senior class members from Oregon Episcopal School. Students like Erica Legler and her new friend, Carla Billington.
Well, I just think it's really good for the kids themselves because they don't have a good, they're not as fortunate as us. And so it's just really neat, I think, that the whole school will be able to get together and do this.
Truly celebrate the diversity that exists here in Northeast Portland. We have kids that come from all over the world, every ethnic background, and it's just a wonderful opportunity to bring the youth together.
And to give them a future, give them some hope.
I know I'm inspired by seeing what's happened through the kids and what they put together, and it can only instill hope. And the youth are here today, and to see that by the looks on their faces.
And isn't that what this season is really all about? In Northeast Portland, with photographer Morris Spence. Paul Gill, Newsroom 6.
as gangs and gang violence become a way of life for some Portland children, many are doing what they can to teach kids a different way of life. Speaking of Hyper Court, the Northeast Portland volunteers are doing their part with a program called Kids at Risk.
The singing and celebrating at Peter Lutheran Church in Northeast Portland is deliberately multiracial today. The community Christmas party pairs 102 people in the Oregon Episcopal School in Southwest Portland with young people from the city's north and northeast side. Although a young man was killed in a gang fight just a few blocks from here on Wednesday, this party is part of a campaign to celebrate life for kids growing up in the neighborhood.
When people hear about the Northeast community, as often, you know, the bad news, but there's wonderful diversity here, the kids are loving. It's just a matter of madness. There's a place for all those wonderful parts of, you know, the human being to come out.
Students from Jefferson High helped too, as did volunteers from the Community Youth at Risk program. But the scope was not limited to this city or country. Among the newest residents of the party, this family emigrated from Russia just last month. The volunteers on this project say they have no grand theory about what causes a child to be at risk. They work with people as individuals. But if that risk comes from crime, or drugs, or an affinity for games, that's where the attention is focused. But everyone can benefit from a community Christmas.
Here, we've got a couple things for you right now. Okay?
There's a gift for every one of the youngsters.
There we go.
But much of what they share with their partners today is intangible and invaluable.
Merry Christmas.
It is. It's a lot of fun. And Sanjay is going. It's a very good thing to have a different kid. And I wish I wasn't a senior because I'm going to do it more next year. But, oh well.
You've been having fun together this morning.
Almost no one has more influence over a little kid than a bigger kid. And today, kids from Jefferson High School and Oregon Episcopal School took some young ones under their wing for a Christmas celebration. This gathering at Redeemer Lutheran Church in Inner Northeast Portland brought together the high school students and young low-income children from the neighborhood. This is the second year for this Christmas party, which was organized to help provide good role models and build self-esteem in so-called high-risk children. And to the kids, it was such a party.
Well, I just share that videotape as a bit of an introduction to the program and the approach that the program, peer ministry, peer support, takes. Some people pointed out before noticing that the it's advantage doing for disadvantaged children, white children doing for a population that is predominantly African American and poor. That while all of that's true, I really want to emphasize the fact that the program has children in relationship, and it's a really important beginning point, and that's the point that the program emphasizes. And if it's a, it's like a theme or the beat of a drum that we continue to do. Something that I had meant, intended to mention, but that class of Oregon Episcopal School also, their senior class for their class project, instead of buying a bench and leaving that for the school, I was able to encourage them to take that money and put on a retreat where they put on a retreat for 20 middle schoolers from their school and 20 middle schoolers from Northeast Portland Middle School. And those youth went away for a 3-day retreat, where the first day of that retreat, they spent time doing a ropes challenge course where you climb trees and get to know each other as team. And then they went out to a mountain campsite. They cleaned the campsite and planted trees. And then on the final day, they did a multicultural awareness where they had a Native American come in and talk to them about the Native American cultural experience. So that's the kind of approach that we do at this program, and one of the reasons is that we don't have many resources. I've really been able to bring community together and by pieces to make that happen. But that's more on the program than I had intended to share with you. I also want to say welcome and thank you. I'm really shocked that so many of you are here. I did everything within my power, by the way, that I described what I was doing to keep you from coming here. So I really appreciate this turnout and your interest in our children. What I'd like to do as a way of beginning, and this is going to take some time, but I think it's really important to get to know each other. And maybe we can just start with this and we'll see how far this goes. You're far more people than I had anticipated. But what I wanted to ask is to go around and ask us to share our name. And for you to go back into your experience as a teenager, and what were some of the identities? What was the identity struggle that you went through as a teenager? What was it that made you feel insecure? What was your button that people may have pushed for you, or you were afraid of people identifying you as? I just think for myself, I didn't think of myself as a very smart student. And I went through, all the way through middle school, really quiet and shy and without any academic confidence. And there was a teacher that I had in seventh grade who responded to my writing. It just totally caught me off guard. And she mentored me into having some sense of confidence. It's like she discovered a side of myself that no one else had told me existed. And that was a really important part of, it's like my life took off. It was another level from then on that it was a real inspiration. And I'd like for you to share some of your experience in growing up as a teenager, as you know, in adolescence. So I'm asking you to be vulnerable because we're not really going to get a real sense of what it's like for our youth until we start to go back and looking at some of our own vulnerabilities, remembering our own teenage years. So, believing in American justice, I'll ask you to begin.
Well, I was born in Idaho and raised on a farm in Idaho, and one of the youngest of a large family, and I always felt that I never could measure up to my older brothers. That might be a normal way of life, I don't know. As events turned out, my life was equivalent to what they did, but when I was younger, it was I was concerned about that. I was concerned that I would never be able to do what my brother Bill was doing, things like that.
Was there someone that gave you a sense of more
confidence? No, not in any particular, but I had a grandmother that was lived to be 96 years old, and she lived with my folks all the time and never had a thing in her life except faith in God. And when I look back, she was always kind of like up there somewhere. Okay. And I think that helped me a lot, really.
What? That's helpful. I'm going to change this in midstream. And I'm going to ask you to share your name and a role model or mentor, like you shared with your grandmother, someone who inspired you and instilled confidence in you in some way. And I'm going to ask everyone in the room to say that. I know that may be harder for you because you're right in the thick of it, right? Who do you, is there someone you look up to right now that makes you feel?
My name is Hilary Flick, and I'm from Port Angeles, Washington. And I've, ever since last year, I'm not one of the best students. I mean, I get in trouble a lot, and I'm usually, I get my name on the board and have to spend, you know, until last year when I really got to, that my teacher kind of put that aside and really, I really branched off from that because I think that was holding me back from my academic achievements and everything. And so And then after that year, that teacher really just put that aside and really helped me to grow into my academics. And I think that's probably the biggest role model so far.
Great. Thank you, Hillary.
Ooh, I'm trying to think of one in particular, but I think it was, oh, I'm Sandy Sanford from Seattle, and it was a junior high teacher, and she was health and PE, and she had a great sense of humor, and all of the kids really loved her for that. It was really strict, but she did cornball things we all love. She was a model for me at that time. And junior high is always a crazy time.
Hi, Judy Johnson from Linden, Washington. And I could have answered the other question better. I couldn't think of anything except that I found myself in college, and I think that some of I had a grandmother who had gone to normal school, which back at the turn of the century was something that, you know, women didn't have that opportunity as much. And my father was also, he had four daughters, but he felt he wanted us to have an education. So I think that I had that influence in my life, and because of going on to a school in higher education, that I was able to find myself. I was really kind of a shy wallflower. That's how I considered myself.
I'm her little sister. That's not how I perceived her at all. I hope you're as good a student as wonderful as your big sister, too. So that was one of my insecurities,
But see, she was not a wallflower. She was really outgoing and gregarious, and everybody liked her. See, you got a little clue here.
We'll meet after the session.
I'm her little brother. I'm Paul Olson. I'm from Rock Island, Illinois. I was really lucky. I had a lot of great role models, and I just think of one was in a different setting. Kind of, was a guy who worked for a grocery store, who it seemed like at least once a week took me aside to just kind of tell me a lesson he learned dealing with people, and he did that all the time.
The influential one that I can think of right now is when I was a senior in high school, and I gave a speech in a speech class, and I was an extremely shy person, and I gave it on slavery and racism in America, and it was the first time I really realized the extent of what slavery and prejudice meant. And so I gave this passionate speech with lots of facts in it and feeling. And the teacher had taught in a university before, and she said that was the most marvelous speech she'd ever had in her entire life of teaching. And I felt like, well, maybe I have some talent, because I didn't have a very high self-esteem, and I had sort of an inferiority complex and was shy. And that was the first time I thought, oh, you know, maybe I have something to say and have some brains and have some talent.
I'm Dorothy Osgood from Minnesota. I can think of a number of teachers, but I'm the youngest of 10 children, and I think the thing that has stuck with me most of my life was that I don't think my parents ever compared me with any of the other children. They treated each of us as complete individuals.
Dean Ostley, also from Minnesota, grew up in a small farming community where I was originally on the farm, and then moved into town. Small class, only 33 in high school. In my class, 33 in class. I guess it was probably, I suppose, the driving force my mother. Neither my mother or my dad, you know, got beyond fifth grade. From the time I was, you know, old enough to hear, you know, the driving force was, you know, you're not going to be uneducated like we are here, coming from the school and the college. But then when I went on to graduate school, I was kind of beyond their comprehension. Did you think it's time to go and get a job? Going to school all the time. But I guess that was probably the driving force.
My name's Walter, I'm from Vancouver. I was pretty unhappy at home through almost all my adolescence, and found that the support that I got, I mean, a lot of support in school, but it was really my youth group at church that I felt at home in. I was what I thought was the real me. And so that was really my support.
My name is Karen Yolka. I'm from Vancouver, British Columbia. I guess I wasn't a great student in elementary school, and it was quite significant for me that I didn't have a teacher in grade 6 that I really felt believed in me and told me so. And I guess things really started picking up for me at that point in my life. Fell in many ways, and it really seemed like once you could sort of get beyond that barrier that success sort of seems to build on success, or feeling good seems to build on feeling good, so that a lot more good things seem to be happening in my life at that point.
I'm Sharon Barnes from Austin, Minnesota, and at various times over the years I've been asked to respond to the same kind of a question, and I can't ever point to a specific person. It seems like at various times in my life there's probably been someone that I don't even realize or don't remember who was there to give me a little nudge or a little encouragement. So I think it's been a whole series of people over my entire life.
Okay.
Keith Barnes, also from Austin, I think of my town that I grew up in, and it was kind of like an extended family, any place that you go in town. So I think I had lots of role models, but I think the number one was my dad, because I think he probably instilled in me a sense of doing the right thing and justice. Perfect.
I think what I'd like to do, because of time, is, and since we've done the inner circle, is ask for volunteers. We have about 5 more minutes that we can take for this. If there are people in particular that feel that they have something a little dissimilar to the examples that have already been shared, as far as role models that have, or mentors that have had an impact in.
But during the teen years, are you talking about?
Yeah, adolescent, teen. Yeah.
Well, now I'm thinking about that. I'm glad I wasn't first, but it's helpful to have time to think. I've been real fortunate to have, my family wasn't strong in the church, and I've had lots of good role models. I grew up here in the village, and there's all sorts of strange people wandering around here, interesting people. And my dad also, I think, was probably a major role model. But as I thought about it, 2 people came to mind in high school. Both had to do with music. One was alcoholic, one was gay. And I don't know that was necessarily important, but I think they both took me into a world and a sense of freedom and looking at things differently that I hadn't had before. My high school music teacher, who was had been a jazz musician and taught in school, and I know he was alcoholic. The piano teacher I took from, who I think was gay, if not, he did a very good job of trying to look like it or act like it in a stereotypical fashion. But I think they had perspectives on life that I had experienced before, and I just grew from that.
Thank you.
Which I had, and I wouldn't think of them as typical role model type of people. I mean, that's my point.
Got it. Thank you.
I'm Kathy Wilson. When I was in high school, I've always looked younger than I am, and now I appreciate it, but when I was in my teenage years, it was horrible, and I had as a child, Penny Mall Epler, who wish didn't help. But I think my youth director, former youth director, when I was in high school, beginning of college, helped me to see beyond all this and to realize that I had value and worth as a person and things to share.
As a teenager, well, at the age of 15, there was an opportunity. I was never raised in a church. We never went to church. I've never seen my parents in church except when I got married. But there was an opportunity. Someone came, knew that there were five girls in our family, and asked someone to come and help on the wheat farm. And I was the one who went, and I never returned home after the age of 15 because I had the opportunity of continuing babysitting and going to school. In my high school, there were only 12 of us in my class. But anyway, the lady that I worked for not only introduced me to Christ, but through confirmation and graduation, they provided me the opportunity for going to college without having to pay back anything but the money, no interest. And she has been a guiding light in my life because through her, knowing Christ, and everyone else were farmers, or wheat farmers, and I was just a hired hand. But through her, I've become what I feel very comfortable with.
Thank you.
I had an unusual growing up years, in the sense that my mother, very, very strong God believer, also has part of her scheme of things that he never, ever praised anybody because that was a little hurt. So I grew up feeling I was probably a quarter inch high, feeling just miserable. I was on the edge of tears probably for 3 years and never cried because you didn't do that when you're probably the water. Cried silently and miserable. I was shy, I wouldn't talk to anybody. But the great thing for me, and I can say it's the Lord's word, is that I found myself as a person for a couple of reasons, but as I really found out I was somebody and important, person in God's eyes, I never forgot what it was like. And as a result of that, I spent some really great years teaching kids and could relate, could sense where they were coming from. And so for me, it was just a wonderful opportunity to become, in my eyes, a superior teacher. The two people that probably affected my life more than any, my mother, and I didn't understand all this praise business till way later. She said, "Oh, you're the greatest fan in the world, you know." And thanks a lot. and somebody
about what made you a superior teacher is exactly why I wanted us to begin with this exercise. For us to remember where we came from, because that's the best gift that we have for connecting with the kids today. Youth today, we think we had it tough before we were discovered, if you will, before someone touched us in a way that helped us to map where we are today. Just imagine what it's like for kids today. And I guess that's what the next piece that I would ask you to do is to do some of that imagining and brainstorm, if you will, what are some of the systemic, some of the issues that we see that kids have to go through today. If we spent some time remembering some of what we went through, what are some of the things that we see that kids, youth, are faced with today? So just peer pressure.
The knowledge that they're important.
The knowledge
that they fit somewhere. They're in the scheme of things.
Okay. Well, they have to discover that the same way we did.
And
such an uncertain future.
Uncertain future. What's uncertain about their future?
Well, the whole prospect of, you know, the earth could just be blown apart, you know, tomorrow. And well, when I was growing up, I mean, the Second World War was going on. I don't think that we ever faced that danger of nuclear bombs or atom bomb or, you know, but just that uncertainty that they face.
Okay.
Okay. Will they ever grow up? I mean, you know, will they reach adulthood?
Okay. Yes.
I think even this Desert Storm situation overseas, where the CNN broadcast, you know, what was happening over there in the front, 24 hours, there was no let up or anything like that. And I know my kids had their eyes glued on what was happening over there, and also the shooting of, you know, missiles and watching missiles being intercepted, these things go through their minds of what would happen if there was a third war, and this is just like the beginning.
Okay, the world could go up, and what's going on with the earth, the war. What are some other things? There's a lot to get out. Yeah.
So many people are so caught up in just survival that the kids don't have anyone to talk with.
Okay.
And get their information from their peers so many times, don't have anybody that they can count on to, you know, to talk to and let out their fears and hopes and dreams and things.
They don't have the families.
Okay, the family.
Both parents work, and time is essence, and they eat like birds, wherever they find it, they eat, and it's just terrible. It makes you kind of hurt to see that, but they're lacking something. They won't have that grandmother there to show them the way.
Yeah, don't wait for me. Get it out. I mean, I've always been told that Holden people were really socially aware and smart. So I want to get all that knowledge out. So I want to hear some things that I don't already know.
Oh gosh, you probably know this. They don't have a sense, I think, of work. I mean, they don't have, how do I say this? They don't have the opportunity to feel self-worth through some kind of work. They have lots of time on their hands and they have nothing to do.
So idle time.
Idle time.
They don't have experience and knowledge of work. Why is that?
Self-worth. I mean, sometimes you feel that if you're able to do something and accomplish something, it builds your self-worth and importance of that person.
Traditional children society would contribute to the family because they were part of the family work that kept the family going.
Yeah. In our community, it's farming is the major thing, and the young people still have that to a certain extent. And in our community, it's real helpful.
I think there's a lot more pressure for the right shoes, the right clothes. I mean, it's always been there, but since television has entered everybody's homes, you know, you get to look pretty, you have to wear this, and it's just...
Some materialism.
Very materialistic.
I think kids are carrying more burden of responsibility for family dysfunction. And what you were mentioning about family stress and dual parents working and marital problems that come out of that, I think because there's more of that, I think kids are carrying responsibility for what's going on in their families, and therefore feeling bad about themselves because that's what our home has come to, and they're carrying that.
I was going to say something like that he just did. I teach in a very low economic area, and I find that the kids have a lot of, I think when we grew up, we didn't know if our parents had a lot of financial troubles because there was food on the table, even if there, you know, was just a little bit of it. And I'm finding that a lot of kids feel a lot of heavy pressure, and their parents put that on them as far as food on the table, the rent that's due, you know, in 10 days. I don't find as much, at least where I teach, as far as that, you know, you have to have a certain kind of clothing because they're just unable to get them anyway, so it doesn't, you know, relate to them. But they have a lot of trouble as far as feeling responsible to also get some of those bills paid because they have a situation where they leave in the middle of the night and they're, because the rent hasn't been paid and they're gone from their stable situation that they've had for maybe a very short period of time, and that they really feel heavy responsibilities in a lot of those cases, and vulnerable if they can do nothing about it. Mm-hmm. And school is very the safest place that they have, because we both feed them, we take care of them, both clothing, because we give clothing to all of our students, and we give them free breakfast, free lunch, and you know, it's a safe environment for them.
I think that a lot of the kids, what I've been sometimes going through, is that a lot of these kids, I mean, they are going to school and everything, but maybe they're like, their parents are never home, never, and a lot of kids, some kids can make it without their parents, but I know that if I didn't have my parents to keep pushing me into making me try harder, that I probably wouldn't have gotten, I mean, I probably wouldn't have wanted to get good grades or anything. I mean, I think that my parents were a good part of pushing, even though sometimes I didn't like the pushing. I mean, when I look back on it, I'm glad they pushed me. And I think that's when a lot of the kids, when they don't have that extra, some kids can make it, but if some kids, they need that push, and if they don't have that push and strain, then they'll just, you know, turn to the streets or something.
Yeah. I'm really glad you're here. Yeah, I'm sure we all are.
Can you lead a session with the kids?
That's right.
Yeah.
And make sure our kids are here.
That's right. Yeah. Well, just to add some of the things that, in my experience, to the list, racism is a major one, and it would seem like a really obvious one as well. Alcohol and drugs, and it just destroys families and make families dysfunctional, and the role that puts the kids in, the behaviors that they pick up. Teachers, the structure, particularly of our urban schools, that there are many teachers who are burned out, teachers that are not supported for their gifts, and they don't want to be there, and they're putting in time until they can go someplace else. The lack of resources to support good teachers, that's a major area that interferes with the self-esteem of our children. Unemployment and underemployment, the working poor and the poor. Education and undereducation. Teen pregnancies is a big one. Someone mentioned idle time. There's a lot of negative behaviors that kids pick up just because they don't have anything constructive to do with their time. Police harassment. We've seen a lot about that on the media. Poverty and peer pressures, as someone has mentioned. And again, racism and hopelessness. So many of these youth don't see that there's an opportunity or how to get out of the trapped sense or environment that they live in. Another big one is that we hear a lot about, at least now we're hearing more and more about it, are morals and values. The spiritual needs of our children. And we're hearing that even within school settings, public school settings. Where are children learning their morals and values? And I would ask that of you, just generally from you, brainstorming again, where do you see kids, children, picking up their values?
TV, television.
Television.
Gangs.
Gangs.
Schools.
Schools. Parents, peers. Yeah. It's interesting the order that we listed those. I think the order was very accurate. 20 years ago, I think the top of that list might have been community and church. Today, it's quite the contrary.
Also, I think 20 years ago, what you'd see in the media was probably more in tune with traditional conventional values. But if, you know, I was just reading a really old Newsweek about violence in the media,
And I think when I was little, I didn't see movies that were like that, where 100 people got shot and it was nothing.
Yeah. If you were a person of color, you would have seen that. Yeah. But now we see that's even inflicted on a larger segment of our society. That's, thank you. That's,
Kelly, you mentioned idle time, and I coupled that anonymity. Number one, just from cars. I mean, kids can now get to where people don't know them, but two, just in the community, that we don't look at kids in the same way, say, I know you, what you're doing. I think we had a drug specialist come in and talk to us, and said anonymity is one of the biggest factors. Kids just have nobody looking at them. You know, they're just, nobody knows who they are. So they,
all right, that's another one that we'll get to. And I have to go back to what I just said about people of color. For women also, I just realized that statement was short-sighted, that women 20 years ago have experienced a lot of violence too on the media, and we're becoming more aware of that today.
I think when you talk about the priority, I sense that our daughters have gotten a lot of values from the home and the media community. I think the television specifically has clouded and questioned those values. But as we have conversation, or even overhearing conversation, I still hear the values that I think they picked up that are really solid. The other just kind of clouds the issue. So I don't think they're getting values from elsewhere. I think they're getting the values from what I would interpret the right place. But I think the questions about those values come up from everything they're inundated with.
I think that's a really important point, but I don't have statistics or anything like that, but do you have any idea how small a percentage of our society you represent? How few parents are spending time with their children and instilling and supporting those values? And how many parents are involved in two jobs or, you know, success with their career? How many single parent homes there are? And then if we get into our really higher risk factors for children who are at higher risk, particularly children whose parents are incarcerated or who are involved in drugs and alcohol dependency, those children, there are many children, and particularly that I work with, who are basically being raised by their grandparents, specifically their grandmother. And that's, of the risk factors, that is the highest. You know, they're hanging on by a string. You know, the grandmother has really strong, for the most part, strong social, religious, spiritual values. But when you look at the risk of age and energy, they're extremely vulnerable, because when that person is sick or, you know, God forbid, that person dies, you know, what's there to support that youth? But that's one of the biggest threads that's going around right now in our community, and the children that we're working with are how many are raised by their grandmother. That's a really tough one. But the clear message that I want to say is that the family structure that you've mentioned, that's not what we see for the most part with our children. And that's not restricted to urban, you know, inner city kids, but that's pretty large segment of our society. So the risk factors have really grown quite a bit, has been mentioned. The next question I have is, who's going to model the positive values and choices for today's youth beyond, you know, the parents that we see? We start looking now at the kids that we see who we're talking about at being higher risk, recognizing that all youth are at risk. But looking at the kids who are more likely to get involved in gangs or teen pregnancy, those higher risk factors, where are they going to come across the kind of models, adult role models or mentors that we were exposed to as we were growing up?
Hopefully through the church.
But those probably kids aren't going to church. So.
But I'm saying that the church should have programs for them.
Right. Well, right now, let's just say, let's put up where where the potential is. The church is one potential. And we'll get to the how-to. Schools?
Community organizations.
Community organizations. Boys and girls clubs.
Sports.
Other family members, mothers, aunts.
Extended family, yeah. Other family members. Okay, now the next question is, how's that connection going to happen for these kids? How's the church involved in their lives for these at-risk kids? How do you fill that gap between their experience and where the church is at? How are we going to fill that gap?
I think one of the ways, and Lutherans need to do a real good look at ourselves, is to be willing to risk our money in ways that are unconventional. We've had all these conventional ways, and you know, come here and have Luther League and go on, and we all know what those are. And they aren't successful. I don't imagine they're successful in your kind of, the kids that you're working with. You come to Luther League, you know, it's not going to work. Maybe I'm saying, and then I'll stop. Just we all got to write the top of the heap of the Lutheran Church nationally and say we got to be willing to take risks and step out into areas that we've never stepped out into before.
I think that's part of the key of going to the kids instead of just expecting them to come.
Also, too, there's a program in the Los Angeles City School System which is called Options for Youth. Now, Options for Youth is a program which is not part of the city school budget, but the teachers are paid on what the kids produce, and also by passing the students and passing them into the regular grades. That means these kids are off the streets. These kids, the girls are pregnant, and I'd say over half the student body of this Options for Youth group are Hispanic, but there's several areas within the city that this, because Los Angeles is so spread out, as most of you well know, my daughter's going to a program called Options for Youth in the San Fernando Valley in an area called San Fernando, and it's a tough area, but this Options for Youth, its location is within a church. They meet in a church twice a week, and they work. The student works with the teacher, and they also bring the work home with them because it's more of a home study type program, and they get graded by what they turn in by homework.
Saved our daughter. She quit going to school.
Yeah.
Now she's ready to go back.
Well, and she didn't want to go to the local junior high school around the area because basically the gangs, the violence, killings, shootings, and drugs in the junior high school, 7th and 8th grade.
I think too that we need to see educating youth as a community activity. It's just not the schools, it's all of us working together. And it seems like we have less and less time, but we need to do that and start a mentor program where you match students with a mentor and provide.
I think many communities are getting the private sector involved. In our community, we've found that entry-level people, whatever their age, but especially youth, are just not prepared for work at all. And so the employers are saying, we have a stake in this and we need to get involved. And they're trying to make partnerships within the schools. I'm sure that a lot of you could name those partnerships where kids have mentors within industry or private business. Where the teachers go into the firm and work in the summertime for pay to help them with their financial problems and also to give them
taste of the real world in terms of what their kids are teaching me to know, that kind of thing. And I think that's a real potential. I think it's bringing up, at least in our community, it's bringing up all over. And there's a lot of interest in it, and there's at least a broader financial base that way. That's the first time I've ever heard of that idea of the teachers working in those other places. I've heard of lots about the people from business coming into the school, but that, I've never heard that before. That's very interesting.
We've had, you know, pre-Amos been doing that for years, bringing teachers in the summers, working. We also have been doing programs for high school kids that come in and spend parts of their time in the corporation on a growing basis.
I think there's another key to it, too, and I don't know, you know, how many university professors are surrounding me, but there are lots and lots of problems with higher education recognizing this kind of a thing, and accepting that as training for teachers, accepting that as another way to extend education. It doesn't necessarily have to be degree programs, but there's a lot of need for that recognition on the part of the institution of higher education. Just as the institution of the church needs to change, the institution of the school and all of that, it's all involved in a community effort.
Well, I need just like 5 minutes. I want to kind of do my little spiel here. But, and it goes back to what my basic belief is, that the church has power, the church has answers. The problem is we don't take the church to the streets. I mean, we have our brick buildings, our places of worship, and it's a very narrow door for people to come in. But if the church would take its mission out into the streets, there's tremendous need for us. And what you basically said out of your own awareness is that there's a need for mentors, there's a need for values, for you know, what the church has to offer. But there's a disconnection between what we see and the reality in which our children live. The reality we lived in not too long ago. And somehow we have to make that connection between the church's vision, the church's mission, and that reality. And the question about our youth groups. Our youth groups is a wonderful place. It would relate very well to children who are at risk. But we're not inviting those children to be in relationship with our youth. The peer ministry program, the program that I direct, is modeled after our youth groups. I mean, that's where the church has a rich tradition for being concerned about our youth, empowering our youth, leading them into productive, positive adulthood. The church has demonstrated that commitment for years. Why don't we do that for children of our community? That's the focus of this program, if I can. Just to go over some of the results of the program. I have about 4 or 5 letters. I feel apologetic about how often they write and they give me credit for this program. They write about what I've done in the public school. I'm the volunteer of the year for Portland Public School for my school district because of the way the church has been present in the lives of those students. Every month we take 8 children out to a restaurant. It's the Western Culinary Institute where they train chefs, and it's one of the best training schools in the Northwest, training adults to be chefs. Each month we take 8 children to that restaurant, and we have local role models come in, indigenous role models, African-American males. Adults of these children are too seldom exposed to because there's so few adult males that they get to see who are successful in our society. So we have people like former Portland Trailblazers, the best team in the United States. Well, we have trailblazers and doctors, lawyers. We have a number of adults that go in, and they just go through that 2.5-hour meal with those kids. And it's something that you know, adults can do and feel comfortable. And it's an opportunity for them too, because they aren't that comfortable or aware of where these children live every day. So it's a comfortable environment. And again, that comes out of the tradition of the church and Holy Communion. What we do when we go to a table and share not with ourselves, just with ourselves, but acknowledging our relationship with all the world. The church has so much power to bring into the lives of these children. The Christmas party, you saw that. Again, Portland Public Schools. I shared the restaurant, the five-star restaurant in August. We're going to take 25 children, middle school and high school children, to a restaurant, and on Saturday they'll be trained as waiters and waitresses. And one thing, it's an imagination for them, it perks their imagination of what they can do to gain income, whether they go on to college or just for income, as teenagers and as young adults. But it also for them is a lot of interpersonal skills that they'll pick up in just taking care of someone in that way. But then on that following Sunday, those youth will be able to invite their parents, their grandmother, to dinner, where they'll serve them that meal in that very special setting. It's a really powerful experience that we're able to do. And again, it's not just for those children, but it's for what happens for the owner of that restaurant to be in relationship with the church, so the practical way that she has power and is in relationship to the church, bringing church and community together. The program was, there was some write-up on the program in the Lutheran, the January 30th article. So this will be here if you care to read through that also. I just have this up here as a reminder that I haven't received a salary yet for the month of July. That's another place where the church has not come through with its power. That here's a program that is being acknowledged throughout the Portland area as having a tremendous impact on children who are at risk and on our church, the power that's happening for our church and being able to make a difference. And yet the resources aren't there because of the way that our church administrates. You know, that even the bishop says that, you know, the bishop is very supportive, but to put a light on this program, what about the other programs that may want that kind of support and recognition? So there's so much that we have to work through with the church. So that's just some, a couple other programs that we do. We sponsor Saturday Gym at Jefferson High School. This is the last one that I'll mention too. The Saturday Gym at Jefferson High School, which is the only inner city school in Oregon, where I do most of my work in volunteering. That on that school, on Saturdays, we sponsor an open gym where there's 100 to 200 African-American male youth that come for that Saturday gym. Now, that's constructive time for those kids where they're not involved in gangs and other activities. The goal of that program is to bring adult male, just pastors from their community in there to just be present with them, to participate in their culture. Because basketball is a very strong cultural identity for those kids, and they're in control. And just to have those pastors be present with them is a really important and powerful thing. And the final one I'll mention is a female support group, where we have 10 females who are dedicating their time to be present to female youth as role models. So that's just some introduction. The next session, what I want to do is present the program to you and have you do brainstorming and give advice on how to make this program most effective. So thank you very much for coming.